Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here is Bob.
We're going to be in Job 20 and 21 today. And as you know, we're in a series of cycles. Back in chapter 2, the three friends of Job were introduced. They are going to speak, and Job's going to answer. And there's a series of three of these cycles. Remember the commentary that I recommended to you was on the Tyndale Old Testament series, InterVarsity Press. On page 22, there is a series of these, and it is chapter 20 is related to chapter 18. Now, chapter 18, Bildad is going to respond to Job. Job is going to respond in chapter 19, a very powerful response. And then Zophar is going to get angry at what Job says in chapter 19, and he is going to just explode in chapter 20. But along the same theological, traditional lines that they had been quoting before. They were not listening to Job's questions. They were just reacting in traditional cliches. And Job's getting a little ticked himself. So let's look at verse 20. Then Zophar. Now, Zophar's first speech is in chapter 11. Now, in the third cycle, he doesn't have a speech. And that's caused people to wonder about the structure. But anyway. Now, remember, this man is called the king of the Minyans in the Septuagint, which is a southern Semitic tribe in Arabia. Also, the name is mentioned in the Septuagint in Genesis 36, 11, and 1 Chronicles 1, 36. But we don't know anything about him. Now, he's called a Naamite. I don't know what that means at all. I don't know where that is. An answer. Therefore, there's three series of parallel phrases here. My disquieted thoughts, my inner agitation, and the reproof which insults me. Now, some wondered what insulted him. When I look up at chapter 19, some think that verse 21 insulted him. Pity me, O you friends, for the hand of God has struck me. They kept saying, no, that's not true. You must have sinned, and therefore God has done that. He said, no, I haven't. Look at verse 22. Some say it's 22. Why do you persecute me as God does and are not satisfied with my flesh? Well, this with my flesh is a homosexual term used of prisoners being abused homosexually. And maybe they were affronted that he would use that word. Now look at verse 29. Another possibility. Then be afraid of the sword for yourselves, for wrath brings the punishment of the sword, and so that you may know there is judgment. Job says, I hope you get it just like I got it. You don't agree with me. And maybe that Zophar. I want to tell you, he's hot and he's slow. He's arrogant. Look what he says. And the spirit of my understanding makes me answer. What he's saying, I know what I say, and I'm going to say it. And he does. Now look at verse 4. He's going to quote this traditional wisdom again. Now remember that Job is wisdom literature. And that's what wisdom literature was, a collection of the practical wisdom of that period of time. So he's just doing what a normal wisdom teacher would do. This is what he says. Do you know this from old, from the establishment of man on earth? What he's saying is, we've always done it this way. You ever hear that? Now, look at verse 5. That the triumphing of the wicked is short, and the joy of the godless momentary. Now, here is the traditional response. In verses 5 through 11, joy is brief for the wicked. Now, is that true? Well, that's what Psalms 37 says. But Job says that's not true. And that's going to be his answer in chapter 21. But that's what they're telling. All three of them saying the same thing, a little different way. Now, notice where it says, though his loftiness reaches the heavens and his head touches the clouds. Now, some have said this refers to the book of Daniel, where Nebuchadnezzar is spoken of as his head touching the clouds, meaning that Job was the greatest of the East, a wealthy and spiritual man, a well-renowned, famous individual. But some have linked it to the metaphors used to describe the king of Babylon, the king of Tyre, that seems to have allusions toward Satan himself, used in Isaiah 14, 13 and 14, and Ezekiel 28, 2 and 17. And I think the metaphor is the same here. Now, it talks about they're going to pass away. He's going to be the wicked will pass away, and where he was, no one will know where he is. Look at verse 10. His sons favor the poor. Now, the second thing they're going to say is, Job, the wicked are not going to prosper. The wicked are going to die young. And then they're going to kind of back off a little bit and say, well, If the wicked do live a long time, then their sons will pay for it. Well, this is traditional theology. But what Job's going to say here is his sons favor the poor and his hands give back his wealth. Now, that means one of two things. It either means that the rich man's sons are going to be in worse shape than the poor, or it means the rich man's sons are going to give to the poor to try to redeem themselves for the way their father acted. Now, which it is, I'm just not sure. Now, look at the last one. His bones are full in his youthful vigor, but he lies down with him in the dust. He's going to die early. That's the assumption. Now, in verses 12 through 18 is the traditional philosophy that sin has the seeds of its own destruction in itself. That's certainly true. And many of these traditional statements have elements of truth in them. We would put it this way as a proverb in our day. Give the guy enough rope and he'll hang himself. Now, that's what he's saying. They're going to say, well, he's going to eat all this rich food, but it's going to turn to bitterness. And so that he's going to pursue that for a while. Though evil is sweet to his mouth, when he hides it under his tongue, though he desires it, it will not let go, and holds it in his mouth, yet his food in his stomach is changed to the venom of cobras within him. He swallows riches, but will vomit them up, and God will expel them out of his belly. God will take the wealth from him if he doesn't. He sucks the poison of cobras, and the viper's tongue slays him. Now, some say, well, the viper doesn't slay people with their tongue. This is poetry. Don't get real uptight over poetry. The snake's tongue is what's most notable. You don't see the fangs. It's just saying that the snake's going to bite him and kill him. Okay, now, let's see. He returns to what he has attained. He cannot swallow it. As to his riches of his trading, he cannot enjoy them. This traditional wisdom that if you live by the sword, you'll die by the sword is before your time. It's kind of what this is saying. Now, in verse 20, because he knew no quiet within him and does not retain anything he desires, nothing remains for him to devour. Therefore, his prosperity is not endure. Now, in verses 20 through 28, the verb tenses change. And they become wishes or desires. They seem to be a curse formula that says, if he does this, I hope this will happen to him. And that seems to be what verses 20 through 23 are all about. Notice it mentions here, when he fills his belly, God will send his fierce anger on him. And the word God, look at your translation. It's in italics. That means it's not in the Hebrew text. And, of course, here we're referring to the Masoretic text. It's supplied, though, because the context demands it. There's some strange things in here we don't understand. The last part of verse 23 is hard to understand. It talks about an unfanned fire. This seems to be lightning, a complete darkness. Darkness was a sign of a plague of Egypt. On the cross, it got dark. It was a sign of a disfavor and that kind of thing. Notice in verse 27, the heavens will reveal its iniquity and the earth will rise up against him. In Deuteronomy 32:1, it mentions about heaven and earth witnessing against somebody. The same is true of Isaiah 1:2. In the Old Testament, it took two witnesses to confirm a truth. And so when God speaks, he calls on heaven and earth to back up what he says because of their permanence. And that's maybe the allusion here. In verse 28, it speaks about the day of God's anger. And they've been talking about that. Now, this sounds real pious and sounds real traditional theology. But what they're really saying is, Job, this has happened to you for a reason. You've done something terribly wrong. And this is justice that you're getting. Now, in chapter 21, Job's going to say, not on your life, dude. This is not something I've brought on myself. I am innocent before God. And all of your little theological cliches don't apply in this case. Now, here is the tragedy, or I should say the common problem, of general theological truth versus individual specific application. Now, that tension all of us have. And Job's going to answer. Then Job answered, listen carefully to my speech. Sometimes I can even say, can you read lips? What Job's saying is, watch me carefully, boys, for I'm about to blast you. You know, he said, I've listened to you. Now you give me attention because I'm going to say something. And let this be your way of consolation. What he's saying is, if you want to comfort me, just listen to what I'm going to say. Bear with me that I may speak. Then after I have spoken, you may mock. Now the you here is singular. Everything else has been plural. So it seems to refer to Zophar, who went on this tirade in chapter 20. Now, there had been a pretty calm conversation before this. They had presented this, and Job had presented this, and they'd presented and Job presented. But Zophar got tacky in chapter 20. Well, friends, I want to tell you, Job's about to level their whole argument in chapter 21. Now, as for me, is my complaint against man? What he's saying, have I been picking on you? And why should I not be impatient? Look at me and be astonished. Put your hand over your mouth. You see, the friends have been talking these great theological generalities. And Job says, shut up and look at me. I'm on an ash heap covered with sores, and I'm telling you, I didn't do anything wrong. So here's where reality confronts the pious wisdom of the traditional teachers. Now, that's what this whole book's about. Now, notice where he says, when I remembered, I am disturbed, and horror takes hold of my flesh. Why do the wicked live and continue on and also become so powerful? Now, I want to tell you, this whole reply of Job is a contrast to what these three men have said. Now, I want you to mark this down. This is a contrast to chapter 18, verses 5 through 21, which is a speech of Bildad. And chapter 20, verses 5 through 11, which is the immediate speech of Zophar. Now, there had been some reaction all the way through Scripture about this traditional view of evil and suffering. Let me give you a few references for you to look up. Look up Psalm 58, verses 1 through 5. Read all of Psalm 73. Jeremiah 12, 1 and 2. And Malachi 3, verse 15, are other places where the unfairness of life is spoken of. Now, is it true that all the wicked die young and have problems? And all the godly are wealthy, healthy, and prosperous? I'm hearing that preached a whole lot today. That if God loves you and if you're committed to Him, that you're going to be healthy and wealthy and wise and happy. That's not true. That theology wouldn't preach in India or South America. And I want to tell you, it won't preach here. Some of the most godly, wonderful Christians I know go through such terrible pain and suffering. Jesus Himself suffered. The apostles, the early church. It does not fit. That's what Job's trying to say. Guys, this does not fit. The wicked seem to prosper in our world, and the righteous seem to suffer in our world. Now, look at verse 8. Well, they're saying, well, then if the man doesn't suffer, his kids will suffer. And that way God's justice will be confirmed. Job says that's not going to hold water either. Look at verse 8 and 9. Well, all the way through here. Their descendants are established with them in their sight, and their offspring are before their eyes. Look, it says they sing. Look at verse 12. Verse 11, they send forth their little ones like a flock. Their children skip around. They sing with timbrel and harp and rejoice the sounds of the flute. Now, what Job saying is, men, I'm righteous, and my kids are all dead. Well, their offspring are before their eyes. This is a contrast to chapter 18, 19. And their house is safe from fear. Job says, not in your life. And that's a contrast to chapter 5, verse 24. The rod of God, that's the God's hand that's on Job. You may want to see an allusion to it in chapter 9, verse 34. Those in verse 10. Now, we don't have a contrast earlier where they say the one who loves God's animals will be fertile, and the one who doesn't, animals will not be fertile. But that's a common Old Testament from the book of Deuteronomy, especially the cursing and blessing section. Job says, my animals were prosperous before they were all killed. And the wicked man's animals seem to always be prosperous. Let's go on. Look at verse 13. They spend their days in prosperity. Who? The wicked. The godless. The cheats. The frauds. And suddenly they go down to Sheol. Now what does that mean? Well, they don't get cancer and suffer for 6 months. They don't get a disease that makes them slowly die. They die quickly on the bed of luxury. Job says, look at me. I'm sitting here with pustules all over my body. I'm a righteous man. Friends, I want to tell you, this may not be real heavy to you until one of your close loved ones who loves God with all their heart gets desperately sick over a long period. It may not be a real problem to you until you go to the hospital and someone starts asking you, "Why me, Pastor? Why me, Pastor? I tried to love God. I did the best I knew how. Why me, Pastor?" And the book of Job will start taking on some real exciting truth after that. Now, because all of us, deep down in our heart, all of us think, if I trust God and if I'm faithful, He's going to protect me from everything. It's kind of like He puts a barrier around us that we shouldn't have any problems or divorce or disease or financial reversals or mental illness or... Friends, I want to tell you, everything that I see in the world, I see in the church as far as problems. God didn't promise to protect us if we love Him. It's not a sign of God's displeasure when problems come. I want you to mark down 1 Peter 4:12 and following. I want you to read it. Because I really think that most Christians believe when problems come that God's mad at them. And that's what the whole book of Job is addressing. And major parts of the New Testament. Now, we continue. The word Sheol is used in several different ways. It's personified sometimes. It's sometimes used for the grave or the pit. Sometimes suffering's involved, sometimes not. I really believe, along with the rabbis, because everybody went to Sheol, it was a conscious existence, but no joy, no pleasure, no fellowship. I believe it was divided into two parts. One part is called paradise, and the other was called Gehenna or Tartarus. I've seen it called both sides in the rabbinical writings. Now, I believe that the rich young ruler who died in Luke 16 went to Hades or Sheol. I believe when Jesus told the thief on the cross, "Today you'll be with me in paradise," he went to Sheol because Jesus didn't go back to heaven for 40 days. So, and I've done a tape called Sheol, Hades, Gehenna, and Tartarus. If you'd like that tape, I hope you'll write us. We'll send you a catalog that deals with all of these places in the Bible spoken of where people go when they die. Now it says, "And they say to God, 'Depart from us. We do not even desire the knowledge of thy ways. Who is the Almighty that we should serve Him? And what would we gain if we entreat Him?'" Well, verses 14 and 15 express the arrogance, the ungodliness of the wicked in their self-sufficient attitudes. The very thing that Satan was accusing Job of going to say, I'm not going to serve God unless He blesses me, is what these wicked people say in verses 14 and 15. What they're saying is, "What's in it for me? If I'm a religious person, what's in it for me?" All these sermons I hear about, "Well, if you tithe, God will make you rich." Always in the back of my mind, a red flag goes up and says, "What's in it for me? Should I tithe to God so I'll become rich? Should I love God so I won't get disease? Should I be active at church so I won't have any problems in my family?" This is a subtle temptation. The word Almighty here, El Shaddai, is the patriarchal name of God. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob did not call God Yahweh, for that name was not used until Moses in Exodus 3:14. They called Him El Shaddai. And so this confirms the patriarchal setting of the book of Job. Now, look at verse 16. And I wish I knew what verse 16 meant. "Behold, their prosperity is not in their hand. The counsel of the wicked is far from me." This seems to be a possible summary of Job's thoughts about himself. Or maybe it's someone's reaction to what he has just said. I really don't know. Now in verse 17 and following, Job is going to come back, and by asking these poignant questions of the common experiences of life, he's going to refute the traditional theology of the wisdom sages. Listen, here's the first one, verse 17. "How often is the lamp of the wicked put out, or their calamity fall on them?" When are they going to get theirs? When is a God of justice going to do what He says He'll do? Now, this is in direct contrast to Bildad's speech, 18:5-6, and Zophar's speech, 20:5. Job's saying, "It has not been my experience that the wicked are cut off early. It's been my experience that the righteous are cut off early." And then he says, look at verse 18. "Are they as straws before the wind and like the chaff which the storm carries away?" He says, is that what happens? Had been my experience. And then this, look at verse 19, very important verse. "You say, And notice that's in parenthesis because the text does not have that. We assume this is, instead of a question, this third thing, he's putting something in their mouth. He's making a sarcastic kind of statement of what they have said to him. But that's not in the text. It's just assumed. God stores away a man's iniquity for his sons. Let God repay him so that he may know it. Now, the traditional view was, in the Old Testament, there's not many great passages on the afterlife. And so the idea was that you loved God here and now, and that somehow maybe there's going to be a fellowship afterwards, but they didn't know what it was and they weren't sure of it. There's only certain places in the Psalms of David and Daniel where the afterlife is really seen as something positive. And so if God is an all-loving, all-powerful God, and he is a God of justice, then he's got to settle accounts in this life. I really believe that some of the development of men's longing for an afterlife came when injustice was the norm of this life. Now, I want to tell you, if there is not a judgment day coming and an afterlife settling, God is not just. For this is an unfair world in which we live. Now, about this theology of a man's sins being put on his children. There are some passages in the Ten Commandments and other parts of the Old Testament that seem to imply that a wicked man will pass on his lifestyle sins and the consequences of those sins unto his children to 3 and 4 generations. But that God passes on love and grace to the man who's loved him to 1,000 generations. Now, there's something there, the character of God. 1,000 generations of love, 3 or 4 generations of wrath. But let me come back and say, let me give you those. Deuteronomy 5:9 and Exodus 20:5 and 6 are 10 commandments. And then Exodus 34:7 seems to back up what I've said. Now, there's been a reaction to that in several parts of the Bible which says, no, and this is not a biblical phrase, but what we would put it, every tub sits on its own bottom. Every man is responsible for his own acts. No, the fathers have not eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. No, every man, the soul that sins, it will surely die. The son will not die for the sins of the father, and the father will not die for the sins of the son. Let me give you these individual responsibility passages. Deuteronomy 14, verse 16. Jeremiah 31:29-34, and all of Ezekiel 18 emphasize individual responsibility. That's what Job is saying right here. Let God repay him so he may know it. He's saying the wicked man doesn't really care for his children. If God's just, let him deal with the wicked man in his own lifetime. Pretty good theology. Now look at verse 22. I wish I knew what it is. I think it's a reaction to the previous statements. Some translators think that maybe it was a scribal addition in the margin that was later put in the text. I don't know. But it looks to me, when I look at it, that it's talking about that God judges the angels. But we've had a lot of ancient Semitic text and related text languages come to light in recent years. And it's possible now, linguistically, to understand the Old Testament in its own day. And I think a better translation of verse 22 would run like this. That he, the High One, acts as judge. What it's saying is that God is the ultimate judge. Not that he judges the angels, but that God himself is the ultimate judge. Now, down in verse 24, it talks about the marrow of his bones is moist. This is a biblical metaphor for prosperity and health. You might want to see Proverbs 8:9. Now, he's talking about in 25 and 26 about death. Death's the only fair thing in life. That's what he's saying. Everybody's going to die, and that's the only great leveler. Now, there are some wisdom sages that taught this. A dog and a lion both die, so do the righteous and the wicked. Let me give you these so you can look them up. These aren't pleasant passages, but it does teach that death closes the door on all men. Ecclesiastes 2:14-16. Ecclesiastes 3:19-20, Ecclesiastes 8:14, and Ecclesiastes 9:2-11. It's sometimes death is not related to how a man lives. I guess that's what it's... The idea of a grim reaper is probably consistent with this particular train of reference, though from the New Testament we learned that is not the case. Now, this last little part, notice it says, "For you say..." Now, he's again asking a question or asserting these farmer friends have said something untrue. This is contrasted with chapter 18, verses 15 and 21, and chapter 20, verse 9. "You say, where is the house of the nobleman, and where is the tent, the dwelling places of the wicked?" Well, there's that similar phrase. It's a metaphor about prosperity. Notice the next one. "Have you not asked the wayfaring men, and do you not recognize their witness?" This is very similar to chapter 20, verse 4, about one said, well, everybody knows. Well, he's saying, you ask anybody who's done much traveling that what you've just said is not true. Anybody who knows anything about this world knows that the wicked prosper and the righteous are often the ones who suffer. Okay, now, notice it says in verse 30, "days of calamity and days of fury." This may be related to chapter 20, verse 28, about the day of judgment coming. Now, verse 30 is another of these difficult verses. It's either irony or it's a strong affirmation. And ladies and gentlemen, I'm not sure. Job is a book of poetry. The overall message is as clear as it can be. But sometimes individual passages are just lost to us. There are more words in Job that we have no other reference to in Hebrew than any other book that I know of. It is so hard to interpret. And so that's why we can't lock it down. But the general message is as plain as it can be. Now, in verses 31 and following, about this thing about death, Job says, "You say that the rich man and the cheating man and the wicked man were going to die and the worms are going to eat him." But he says, "You know what I found? I found the rich, wicked people have the biggest funerals you can imagine. Everybody walks in their funeral." Isn't that what verse 33 and 34 are all about? Yep, that doesn't seem right. Sometimes godly men die unnoticed, horrible deaths, and rich, wicked men have great, elaborate funerals, and everybody's saying what great people they are. That doesn't seem fair. Well, Job is trying to really bring into question the traditional theology that if you love God and you don't do anything bad, He'll prosper you. And if you sin or make God mad, He's going to give you poverty or disease. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I believe sometimes that traditional theology is true, but not every time. And we can't make simple little statements. That's what Job's saying. He's saying, you've made some little simple cliches about the way things are. And then he says, look at me, boys. It don't fit in my case. So we got to be careful about making broad generalizations. We got to be sensitive to let God be God in individual lives. And sometimes there's just mystery.